Welcome to the Popcorn Talk Network, for the online broadcast network that features movie discussion, news, and interviews. Press one.
Popcorn Talk. We talk movies.
The Popcorn Talk Network and producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, and Phil Svitek. This is I Talk Movies, long-form interviews with leading members of the film industry. And now, your host of I Talk Movies.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. The sound of that can only mean we're doing one movie. That's Sharknado. Today we have the writer of the franchise, Thunder Levin.
Hello.
Hey.
Welcome, Thunder. We have, of course... This is, Sharknado is just so huge. And July 22nd is coming out with the third one, so we're all gearing up for a very exciting premiere.
Who would have thunk it?
I know.
That should have been the tagline.
Who would have thunk it? But I'll tell you, for the third one, I was suggesting that it should be Sharknado 3, The Unbearable Lightness of Being. No, nobody went for that.
And this Sharknado, you make a cameo.
I do.
Our very own Maria.
Absolutely. We had a great scene together in the White House.
That's right. And before we fully dive into everything, allow me to introduce to my left, Candice Buenrostro.
Hello, hello.
And, of course, Dimitri Panos.
Hello, movie fans.
All right. So, there's various points that Dimitri, you know, he's going to kind of ask his questions. Candice has her own. But for me, I want to start with this. I was watching the Sharknado Feeding Frenzy documentary.
I haven't seen that, so don't quiz me on it.
I'm not going to quiz you on it, but they kind of had a chapter where, you know, everything right off the bat was tough for them to get greenlit or find a director, find a writer, and then they kind of glanced over the fact that, you know, and then they hired Thunder Levin. You know, and it was literally a 5-second thing, and then, you know, you wrote the movies.
Great.
But how did it come to being?
I'm glad to hear they paid so much attention to me.
But so kind of, you know, because they spent, can you expand upon that, how you really actually did get involved in this?
I think probably the reason they had a hard time finding a writer is that I turned it down. When they first brought it to me, it wasn't called Sharknado, it was called Sharkstorm. I had just finished a film at the asylum that everyone was very happy with called American Warships. And they wanted to know what I wanted to do next. And I had some ideas. And then they said, well, we've got this thing we'd like you to do called Sharkstorm. And I said, why would I want to do that? We've had a lot of shark movies. We've had a lot of storm movies. Let's do something new. So we started talking about other projects. And then like a month later, they came back to me and they said, forget Sharkstorm. We want you to do Sharknado. And I said, what do sharks have to do with the North Atlantic Treaty Organization? Because I heard Sharknado. And no, a Sharknado, a tornado full of sharks. I said, oh, well, that's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. And as long as I can play it that way, I'm in. Because, you know, the Asylum has a tendency to play all their movies very straight. And I didn't see how you could do that with a movie called Sharknado. It had to be ridiculous. And it had to have a certain level of self-awareness.
Mm-hmm.
And so from that point on, it was just go. And originally I was supposed to direct it. But then when the time came, I actually had another project that was scheduled to shoot at the same time. And because I'd already done one tongue-in-cheek disaster film called Mutant Vampire Zombies from the Hood, I figured let me do this serious science fiction film and let somebody else take a crack at Sharknado. Maybe that turned out to be the dumbest decision I've ever made. I don't know. But I think everything worked out just the way it was supposed to, because Anthony did a great job directing Sharknado, and I have this serious science fiction film to complement the insanity that we've now created here.
Looking back on it, just to go off of the, you know, if you were to kind of look back at the experience, how different would your Sharknado be from Anthony's if you did have the actual ability to direct it?
Well, That's a tough question, because one of the other contributing factors to me choosing not to direct it was that I'd written a script for a $100 million film, and I really wasn't quite sure how we would do it on a $1 million budget or less. So I don't know. I mean, my concept had Los Angeles completely flooded, you know, people wading around in water up to their waist so that sharks could be coming at them from below, even in the middle of the city, as well as from above. And probably I wouldn't have pulled that off any more effectively than Anthony could have. So I don't know really how it would have been any different.
Mm-hmm. Okay, fair enough. Candace, do you want to get into some of your questions?
In the future, do you see a mutant vampire zombie and Sharknado, you know, coming together to join forces?
Probably not. I mean, they've already done Zombie Shark. I think I've seen that. And my zombie film was not an Asylum project or a sci-fi project. So I wouldn't want to start commingling the rights anyhow. But there are lots of ways we can go with Sharknado. There are so many more things we can still do with it. I'm not sure that mutant zombies are necessary.
Fair enough.
Dimitri?
Yeah, I wanted to just, you know, Sharknado just tapped in to something. I mean, it tapped into pop culture in a way that it literally, it took the internets, it took the United States, like, by storm, no pun intended. When you were writing this, like, was there any inkling at all? I mean, you had a great title. I mean, Sharknado, Nuff Said, was the tagline because it said it all. So I was hooked in. I like shark movies. But I just had no idea. The Twitterverse exploded. The internets exploded with Sharknado when it first aired. Was there any inkling that this was going to be, like, this was Sci-Fi Channel's, like, one of their biggest ever hits?
Yeah. When I finished the script, long before it even started shooting the film, I remember joking to somebody that someday I'd win an Oscar, and all anyone would want to talk to me about would be Sharknado. I'd written this crazy thing. There's no way we could have known the extent of what would happen. I mean, anybody who says they knew it all along is lying. But, you know, like a week before it came out, there was some buzz starting. I remember, you know, it aired like July 8th or 11th or somewhere around there.
And that's at the peak of Shark Week, typically.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I'd actually gotten calls from a couple of friends on the East Coast after July 4th, and there had been a two separate July 4th parties, and both of them called me and said, hey, people have been talking about Sharknado, you know, from the commercials and stuff, because it was before it had aired. And I was like, they have? That's bizarre. And so then the buzz sort of was starting to build. There were a few interviews that we'd all done, and we were starting to get a little press from, like, the B-movie press, but no mainstream attention. There was no indication that what was going to happen would happen. And, you know, then Mia Farrow tweeted about it and all hell broke loose.
Let me, you know, in terms of the way the third movie is being promoted, you know, in the trailer it says, you know, most sequels take years to get to. We right. deliver when the fans want it, sometimes even before it's even ready.
Before it's ready, yeah.
So, you know, When obviously the first one was a success that it was, and then you had to do the second one, in realistically a very short amount of time, how do you as a writer now, you know, come up with ideas, deliver that, and, you know, do you adjust, do you keep, like, how was the writing of the second one now that you had?
It's magic.
Were you even thinking sequel, sitting down writing a movie called Sharknado?
No. When I wrote the first one, there was no thought of a sequel at all. I mean, Who thought anybody would even see it? It was just this crazy little film, you know, and a few people who watch B-movies would watch it and tune in. When it blew up that night, you know, and everybody started saying, oh, now there'll be a sequel, I remember I called up the Asylum the next morning, and I said, hey, you know, if because it wasn't in my contract that I would get first refusal because nobody expected anything to happen. And so I called them up and I said, hey, you know, if there's really going to be a sequel, I'll be hired to write it, right? And they said, well, sure, but there's never going to be a sequel. This is you know, our 15 minutes. It's all going to be over tomorrow, and nothing will ever come of it. But then it kept going, and it just got bigger and bigger, and people kept talking about it. And then every time they repeated it, the ratings went up. And so it was just kind of bizarre.
And then it did something that was sort of kind of crazy. Not only did they have another broadcast, like, almost a month away or a couple of weeks after, but then it went legitimately theatrically.
Yeah.
It played as alternative content. Now, in my recollection, which can sometimes be hazy, I can only recall one other time when something from television actually, in its form, made a leap into the big screen for a short time, and that was the mid to late 70s Battlestar Galactica.
I was thinking that.
And that's the only time I can ever recall. And they basically took the television pilot, a couple of re-edits, they made it 125 minutes, and they released it. They added Sensoround. So
yep,
I was
Sensoround.
There.
Sensoround. I was there.
So it's the only other movie and that I can recall that ever kept its true form,
right,
that was broadcast on TV first, then shown theatrically. And well, Lucas did it, and it was it made close to around $200,000.
Yeah,
I heard.
I wonder about that figure, because everybody I talked to who went to see it that night were saying that the theaters they went to were sold out. And certainly the theater in downtown L.A. was sold out.
Yeah.
So I wonder at that number being so low.
But the way I look at it is, that's crazy that you even had $200,000 considering something that was on TV
right,
for free.
You could see
all
it for
this
free.
Publicity.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, I mean, to me, $200,000 should have been icing on the cake. It should have been like, wow, this is what
right.
we're able to do.
Well, sure.
You know, there was some, I read some things saying, oh, it didn't quite take a bite out of the box office. I was like, what were you expecting?
Right, right. And of course, it was a midnight show.
Right.
So, that limits the audience right there. And it was just a single
right.
screen. Although, in the L.A. theater I was at, and in New York, I heard, they actually added screens because the first showing was sold out. So that was incredible. It was a great night. You know, we had the whole marquee at the Regal Cinemas downtown. It looked like a big blockbuster opening. It was
right.
it was amazing. We had the red carpet and everything. It was a great night. I think the reason that worked is that Sharknado was a communal experience. What makes Sharknado work is people tweeting about it to
mm-hmm.
each other and making jokes about it. And sharing it with their friends. And that's something, you know, frankly, that we've lost over the last 10, 15 years. I mean, you know, go back to the very beginning of human society. We have always had this sort of shared communal storytelling experience, whether it's
right.
cavemen sitting around a campfire or the Greek amphitheaters, or just 30 or 40 years ago, you'd get 1,000, 2,000 people sitting in
right.
a big single-screen movie theater sharing the same experience. And it sort of gives us a common language,
mm-hmm.
if you will, that we've all had these same experiences. In the last 10, 15 years, as the way we get media has fractured and everybody's watching shows at different times on their phone, on their computer, on TV, even when you go to the movies, it's just a little multiplex, you know, maybe 100 seats or something. We're not getting that shared communal experience. And so when Sharknado premiered, and everybody was talking about it, and the Twitterverse was almost more important than the movie itself. That was really sort of the first shared communal storytelling experience of the internet age. And, you know, so in a way, Sharknado saved the world.
Yeah, in a way. Well, I have something to share, too, because I did not watch Sharknado, whether I wasn't around or I forgot to DVR. I did not watch it on its initial first night. But the next morning, when I started reading the tweets, I honestly felt as if I missed, like, an event. And not, like, a reality television series, because this should be in my wheelhouse. The people that know me, I love this sort of stuff. I love these B-movies. I love science fiction and horror and shark movies. And Jaws is one of my favorite movies of all time. So, like, I should have watched it. But then I read a tweet from Damon Lindelof that just, I mean, it had me in tears. I thought it was the funniest thing that he had ever written. And I was like going, and he basically said, correct me if I'm wrong, writing the sequel right now should have it done by the end of Sharknado.
Right.
Should have Sharknado 2.
Right.
So I thought that was hysterical. And
the surreal thing about that is that I saw that and I replied to him. And I said, well, I hope you'll let me work on it with you. and I don't remember what he said to that. He's, you know, sure, you deserve it. But then I replied that I'm looking forward to it, but I don't think it should be a sequel. It should be a prequel, only not quite. You know, because he had just done
Prometheus,
which actually my friend John Spates had written, and then Damon rewrote it to make it not an Alien prequel.
Right.
So I sort of... And
did he get the joke?
He did, and he replied, touche. So that was actually the highlight of my night that night.
Have you remained in touch after Sharknado 2?
Alas, not. I asked him if he'd like to meet, and he said sure, and that was the very last I ever heard from him.
Speaking of, did you... because I know Anthony and those guys, they said, you know, that they like to tweet the stuff together, and so they all had a community. Were you part of the people that, you know, that knew they would sit down and tweet along with the movie?
Well, sure, that's what we were doing. I mean, I had done that for American Warships, and we had, you know, maybe 100 people tweeting to us at the most, you know, and most of them telling us we sucked, and a few asking intelligent questions. And so when I got on Twitter that night, I was expecting that kind of thing, that we'd answer a few questions about how the film was made, and we'd listen to people telling us, you know, how bad we were, and that would be the end of it. And so when I actually got online and the tweets just kept coming in, you know, every time you hit refresh, there were 200, 500 more tweets. There was no way to keep up with them. It was like, my God, something's happening here.
It was
just surreal.
I wanted to ask, like, how and where do you think that turn could have happened? Because you're right. I mean, there's so many haters out there, and you could look at a movie like this and literally... You know, you could be a hater, and
there are plenty of them.
But you know, but I don't see it for Sharknado. I think that it's so ingrained currently in pop culture, but in a really positive way. Like, it makes people like laugh, like, and which is, to me, that's a really great sign. When do you think that this like getting Damon Lindelof, Mia Farrow? I mean, they were actually watching this live. And they were tweeting about it, but in a fun way.
Right. Well, I think, I mean, I trace it to Mia Farrow's tweet.
Right.
OMG, 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 Sharknado. Yeah. But there were others. I mean, Will Wheaton was tweeting about it early on. Patton Oswalt, Judah Friedlander. I attribute it to the commercials that were just so absurd that people had to see what this was about. I really go back to that very first poster.
No, yeah.
Because the tagline, Enough Said, was perfect. I was worried, after I'd written this, and then I, you know, didn't have much to do with it, I was worried that they weren't going to get it. That the Asylum didn't get it, that Sci-Fi wouldn't get it, that the marketing department wouldn't get it, and they would just present this as a serious Sharks in a Storm movie. And when I saw that poster... and the tagline was Enough Said, I was like, oh, thank God.
Yeah.
Because they were on the same wavelength we were. And if they presented it like that, people were gonna get it, and it would turn out okay.
And you had a great title. They always talk about when you're making a movie, try to make a title that grabs. Like, one word is, you know, Jaws.
Right.
You know what you're getting, right?
Right.
Back to the Future. And there was actually fights about that. I'm reading this book about the making of that trilogy, and Sid Sheinberg says, well, no, why don't we call it Aliens from... He was like referencing a thing that happened in the movie, and they're like, no, we got... It says it all. The Godfather says it all.
Right.
Now, I know this is part of this is in the marketing for that new trailer for Sharknado 3, which I think is great. It's like in the franchise histories, there's Star Wars, there's Godfather, now there's Sharknado. But for me, it was
that
title.
That seems like a fair comparison.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. But I get the joke, but still Sharknado is a title that says it all.
Sure.
It's all you need to know. It's like, sharks in a tornado, I'm in.
What like, else is there?
Yeah. How does this happen?
And so people ask me, you know, what other... creature and nature mashups will be next. I'm like, we've done it. You don't need anymore.
For Sharknado 3, your cast is pretty extensive with, you know, celebrity cameos and whatnot. Did any of them reach out to you via Twitter like, oh my gosh, I want to be in Sharknado? Or did you handpick any of them? Or how did that come about?
It really happened that way for the second one.
Oh, cool.
You know, because Will Wheaton had tweeted about it, and Judah Friedlander especially had actually contacted our director over Twitter about it. And so they were talking. And so the fact that so many celebrities were tweeting about it, that just made it an obvious thing for the second one. And that's how a bunch of them got involved. For the third one, that was already an established thing that obviously had to be part of it. So, you know, mostly we reached out to them. Some of them reached out to us. It went every conceivable way.
So let me ask you this for the second one in particular, right? Because this is a moment where it's a celebrity, but using the celebrity as a deeper pun. And, you know, you have Damon John from Shark Tank.
Right.
And he gets eaten by a shark because he's kind of like a shark himself.
Right.
And so how do all those elements come together, both writing-wise, casting-wise, you know, where you have that perfect level of everything just hitting?
Yeah, did you know, too? Like, was it organic in writing these? Did you know that so many cameos were going to be in? Were you writing this organically, or did this come up, oh, we can get somebody in here, like...
Well,
writing
this we knew there were going to be a lot of cameos, so I would write a lot of brief parts that could be shot in one day to suit that. And at the same time, there were a lot of people who were cast at the last minute that we didn't have parts for, and we'd have to very quickly create them. I was very pleased that the Penn and Teller got cast, because that actually happened soon enough that I was able to write the scene specifically for them. And, you know, the thing about Sharknado is there's no intentional comedy in that we don't tell jokes, right? The humor is in the fact that we and the audience are in on the joke, but the cast is never in on the joke, so they're not the cast. The characters are never in on the joke, right. So they're not telling jokes. But by having Penn and Teller in it, because they're comedians, it seemed like here was the opportunity that I could actually tell a joke. And I actually got to do a little setup and a payoff and write an actual joke, which I don't get to do in this whole trilogy. So that was fun. And then there was one time where we had we were shooting out in the middle of nowhere doing the military base scene, and we had two people cast for one part.
Yeah, I've heard you tell where you had to rewrite it on your dog's back.
On my dog's back. So we're in the middle of nowhere, and I have to rewrite it on the set, and I don't have a computer, I don't have anything, and the director is freaking out because the sun's going down, and he's like, you got to write some new dialogue for this. So literally, I called my dog over because we'd been using him in a scene, and I had him just stand there, and I said, stay, and I got a piece of paper and a pen, and I put it on his back, and I started writing this dialogue and hand it to Frankie Muniz and say, here, say this. They rolled the cameras, they shot the scene, and that was it. It was great. And that's the kind of craziness that happens.
Is it, were any celebrities, you don't have to name names, but...
No celebrities were harmed in the making of this.
Hopefully not. But were any celebrities, when you like wrote something for them, especially in the moment of like, wait, I can't do this, you know, did anyone have that sort of hesitation? Much like Ian and Tara had when, you know, when they were filming, they were told it was Dark Skies in the
right.
initial one, and then there's Sharknado, and like... What movie are we in? We're out.
No. Fortunately, because at this point, you know what you're getting into. At this point, the product is clearly labeled. and so anybody who does it knows what they're getting into. I didn't witness this, but I did hear that when Jerry Springer showed up on set, it was raining. And he said, we're not shooting in the rain, are we? And obviously he'd never been on an asylum film because we don't stop. You know, we only have 3 weeks to shoot these movies. And so whatever's going on, we keep shooting.
Plus it's Sharknado.
You have to.
I mean, that's with the second one, part of it, what I love, you guys shot in the middle of February. And it's like, okay, well, clearly the Sharknados bring the cold air.
That was torturous. It wouldn't have been so bad if it were a winter movie. But it was supposed to take place in the summer because it was going to come out in the summer, so they wanted it to be a summer movie. And so to shoot this summer movie in February during the polar vortex, it was the coldest New York had been in, you know, however many years. It was just crazy. And that day at City Field, the wind was blowing and it was snowing, and then the sun came out, and then it was snowing again. And it got to a point where everyone was so cold that their mouths wouldn't work right. And people were starting to slur their speech, even on camera. And they actually had to bring in heaters and put them just out of frame, under the shot, to blow warm air on the actors' faces so that they could just speak English. It was just brutal. But it added to the production value to have all this crazy weather. It actually made it look better.
Yeah.
I like in the cameos, just to go back to the cameos for 1 second, I like in the cameos to Batman. Phil had brought up the Batman, the old television series, Adam West.
Right.
And one of the things for
this
his little...
This was before we went on air, for those who were wondering when this was said.
We talked a little Batman, but it harkened back, because back in the 60s, when the late 60s, when that show was really popular, it was extremely popular, they actually had people call up the series and go, hey, how do I get on this show?
Right.
How do I get to be a cameo on this show? And here we have Sharknado so many years later, and people actually tweeting, hey, I want to be on. Like, I want to get in on this show.
Right.
And you're not having... And it's again, when you get Mia Farrow to tweet, you're getting high-caliber people saying, hey, I appreciate... I get this. It's fun.
Right.
You know.
Well, I mean, I don't really, as the writer, I don't really get much input into casting. But when I was writing the part of the mother, I thought, wouldn't it be wild if we could get Mia Farrow to do it, of Tara Reid's mom. And of course, that didn't happen. We got Bo Derek, who's so perfect to play Tara Reid's mom. I mean, it's probably even better. You start thinking about these things. Well, if we got them, maybe we could get... You know, so my dream, has, as I've said, is to get Harrison Ford in one of these.
And that'd be awesome.
Probably won't happen. But.
Well, he did Expendables 3, so why not?
That's true. Well, I'm sure he got paid a lot of money for that, and we would, you know, pay him, I don't know, $1,000 or something.
Can I just tell you, my most favorite scene is when Ian Ziering is eaten by shark, and he chainsaws his way out of the shark to save himself. Mm-hmm. That was just...
In the first one?
Yes.
I think that's everybody's favorite scene. It's certainly mine.
Yeah.
And what especially warms my heart about it is that it's the same shark that Cassie Skirbo's character was eaten by. And so when he cuts his way out, he pulls her out after him. There was some question as to whether that was going too far or not. And I was like, it's Sharknado. We can't go too far. It'll be good.
I like that. We can't go too far.
This is a movie about jumping the shark. Every time someone says... I think you're jumping the shark now. It's like, no, that's what it's about. We jump the shark. That's the purpose of this film.
You jump the shark with the title.
Jump the shark. Yeah. We jump the shark from day one.
In terms of, you know, obviously the, you know, I've heard you kind of talk about the, you know, the killings of the sharks. And obviously the last shark at the end of each movie has to be the biggest sort of kill. But just in general, plotting of the story, you know, forget the elements of now, you know, there's cameos that you got to now write in. But just in general, when you look at it from an outline perspective, like, how do you start?
It's a mystery. you know, the first one was actually easy because, A, nobody was paying attention. It was just this crazy movie, and nobody knew what it would become. And so I was pretty much left to my own devices. And so I started, okay, how do I justify a tornado full of sharks? So it was a matter of, okay, we'll have a hurricane. Hurricane hitting Los Angeles. That's never happened, and this city is so unprepared for that. And with global warming, you know, it could happen. What would happen if a hurricane hit Los Angeles? I mean, if it rains for 5 minutes here, the streets flood. So, I mean, we'd need submarines to get around town. So I started with this realistic disaster scenario. What would happen if a hurricane hit LA? And then, okay, well, hurricanes spin off tornadoes. That actually happens. And if a tornado forms over the ocean, it will suck up the water and become
a water spout.
Yeah. So, okay, if there were a lot of sharks in that spot near the surface, the water spout could suck them up. There have been documented cases of fish falling from the sky that were sucked up by weather phenomena. Usually they're very small fish, but we just expanded on the idea and took it to its perfectly logical conclusion. So that all just came together, and I put myself in the part of Finn Shepard and said, what would I do if this happened to me? With the sequels, it gets more complicated because there are a lot more eyes on it. You know, so you've got all the executives at the asylum, all the executives at Sci-Fi, and Anthony, and they've all got their ideas. And that all has to be sort of filtered down to what is the core of this story and how do we make it work. And so that outlining process has become a lot more complicated because you've got to take everybody's ideas, everybody's opinions into account, and then come up with something that will satisfy everybody and hopefully satisfy the fans, because it's only because of them that we're here. So that's difficult, and that's a lot of intricate plotting. And for the third one, we went through several different versions of the story outline before we got to something that was finally approved. In the first outline version that Anthony and I were happy with, it was basically a father and son road movie. It was about Finn's character and his father making their way across, not across country, down the coast, to make sure that Finn got to be with April before she gave birth. And I guess the reaction from Sci-Fi was that that's great, but we don't want it to be we don't want it to be a story about old people. So get young people in there and make the father and son thing just a smaller part near the end. So that whole thing started to change. And then bit by bit it changed. I know at one point part of it was supposed to take place in Miami, and Nova was going to be with April for a big part of it. And I thought that was interesting because there's this simmering tension between April and Nova, because April's jealous and Nova wants Finn. And so that would be interesting. And getting Tara and Cassie, you know, stuck together for half of the movie playing off each other would be fascinating. And then that didn't happen. And people wanted Finn and Nova together. But you can only play their tension so far, because this movie, the whole trilogy, really is about Finn rebuilding his life and his family. And so you can't let him stray too far in that direction. You know, despite Nova being so hot and obviously being interested in Finn. So I got to play with Nova having a sidekick who would have a crush on her and would see how she was attracted to Finn and would get jealous about that. So that's where I got to play with some of that without actually having to have Finn, you know, be too tempted.
Got it. And one of the questions, you know, as fan, because you took, right, obviously the movies tell that line, but fans always ask, like, you know, when will these people learn about these sharks? Like, when will they learn from their history of, like, how to prevent these things, how to deal with these things? And how do you keep answering that question, you know, now with the third movie? And, you know, people are always like, what, you know, keep Sharknado going until Sharknado 50.
Right. Well, that's one of the things that we do for the first time start to deal with in the third movie. You know, in the first movie, of course, it had never happened before. It was a complete surprise. And in the second movie, who could have ever thought it would happen again? And what were the odds it would happen while Finn and April were in the same place? You know, what are the odds? Now we have to start dealing with, are these storms following them? Are they causing it somehow? And what is causing it? So that's stuff that we start to deal with. In this film, we sort of ask the questions for the very first time. In the first two movies, we never asked why is this happening or how is it possible. You know, we just ran through the wet paint as fast as we could and hope nobody saw our footprints. In this one, we finally recognize that people are starting to notice our footprints, and so we have to look back and go, oh, look, we left footprints. We're not answering the questions yet, but at least we're starting to ask them.
Got it.
Someday we'll have to answer.
Well, you know, I wanted to talk to you because I read somewhere where you were great advice for aspiring screenwriters. So I'm going to paraphrase here. Where basically you said you write the best possible screenplay you can. Write the best possible screenplay you can, and then basically show it to everybody. And they, you know, from family to friends to so-so acquaintances, when the family member says, this is a great script, then the friend says, this is a great script, to the people that you barely know, this is a great script, and so on and so forth. So, I don't know, so yeah, that still holds true. So, when you were writing Sharknado, did you adhere to your advice? Because, I just wanted to know, was there a family member or a friend that said, this is freaking hysterical, like, this is, like, great, like...
No. I didn't have to, of course, because it was an assignment. Okay. So it wasn't a script that I was writing to try and break in. You know, I'd been doing this for a while. And I had professional people who were paying me to do this, mm-hmm. who would give me feedback.
Right.
So I didn't really send it around to any of my usual suspects, to family or anything. The truth is, I wrote that first movie just to amuse myself. I mean, I wrote it as a job.
You amused a lot of people.
But I did this because it amused me. And the way I approached it was, this is something I'd like to see. This is me having fun with it. And fortunately, it appealed to a lot of other people, too.
So with that, with the success that Sharknado became, and then Sharknado 2, basically, you know, it's giving you some cred. It's giving you, like, some celebrity status. You're the Shark... Well, I mean... Because it's so big. Uh-huh. And again, you are the credit for this pop culture, in a sense, phenomenon. Mm-hmm. So with that, I mean, there's good. Like, you get to be on this fine, awesome show.
Absolutely.
This is actually
the best thing that's ever happened to me right here.
Well, at least for the next 15 minutes. But with that, though, being this town could, you know... This town turns on a dime, and you know your success over here. Was there a hindrance with that? Did it in any sense? Like, did some dopey, quote unquote, creative exec, ever, if you're trying to pitch anything other than Sharknado, and you're going outside of the Sharknado wheelhouse, they said, "Oh, he's just the guy that wrote Sharknado." Do you ever have to, deal with that kind of Hollywood craziness?
Sure.
And how do you cope with it?
This is something that Anthony and I have both been dealing with, is that Hollywood doesn't quite know what to make of us.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we've created this thing that is taking the world by storm, but Hollywood, by and large, doesn't want to do campy movies. So is that all we can do? So it's a double-edged sword, because I'll go in and, my agent will prep whoever I'm meeting with by saying, look, he's more than Sharknado. He does serious stuff, too. And so I'll go in and I'll pitch serious stuff, and maybe they're expecting Sharknado-esque mm-hmm. stuff. Or I'll go in and pitch Sharknado-esque stuff, and they'll think, oh, that's all he can do. And that's not what we want.
Right.
It's been a very interesting tightrope to walk. And I've my initial reaction after the first one was to go out and pitch serious stuff that I'd already been working on for years. I've got a big science fiction epic that I'm in 2176 that I've been talking about that for generations, it seems like now. I started working on that in the 90s. And I have some dark thrillers and some other mm-hmm. stuff. And I started pitching that and wasn't making the progress I wanted. So I developed this TV series called Dive, which is Sharknado-esque in tone, but it's sort of the next step. It's a step that the Sharknado fans will like its sense of humor, but it also gets into more real science fiction. And I finally now got a couple of producers attached, we got a star attached, and just this past Thursday, we started pitching it to the networks. And hopefully sometime this summer... We'll get a deal on that, and we'll get it on the air, and then it'll be more than just Sharknado.
Good.
We can move in new directions, and that'll at least take me a step towards doing more serious stuff.
Sure.
And then maybe I can get my big science fiction epic going.
Well, if it's any consolation, and I'm sure you know this, I had read James Cameron is someone who is at least one director that had inspired you, and he started off with Corman and Piranha 2.
Right.
So his movie was about flying piranhas eating people at a beach resort. He wrote Terminator while being a truck driver. Mm-hmm. So, did any of this go like, hey, look what can happen?
Oh, sure,
absolutely.
I mean, a lot of famous directors came out of Roger Corman's class.
Ron Howard, another one.
And I worked there when I first came to Hollywood. I worked on three movies for Roger. So absolutely, James Cameron was a big career path model for me. And we'll hope for the best. I mean, I had always intended to do a little film that became a cult classic, and then that would let me do something bigger and something bigger. I didn't expect it to take me 20 years. And Sci-Fi Channel movies didn't exist when I was first having this thought back in film school. But I'm content with this path as long as I get to keep walking it.
So, for the screenwriters out there, if you could, in a sense, because you said 20 years, what was You went to film school. What brought you, what inspired you to come out west, give this a shot? You obviously did not give up. So that's another really big thing. So many people can come out to Los Angeles with their dreams and doing whatever, but they'll give up after 2 years, three
right,
years.
Right.
For you, what was it? What inspired you? And what could you share with somebody who's in a similar position, whether they want to direct, because you've directed as well, you produce, and you screenwrite, and you act?
Well, I don't act. Don't ever think I act.
You cameo.
I cameo, and you will notice that none of my cameos have actually had dialogue, and there's a reason for that. In fact, my cameo in this third one, I'm about to say something, and I get cut off, and I wrote it that way because I did not want to speak on camera. I love movies. That's what it boils down to. I love movies and TV. This is what I've wanted to do since I can remember wanting to do something. Well, when I was very little, I wanted to be the guy who drove the back of the hook and ladder fire truck. But once I got past that and past wanting to be an astronaut, this is what I wanted to do. And so the idea of giving up never really occurred to me because there's nothing else on earth I'm qualified to do that I could get paid for. And so I kept going simply because there was no choice. But yeah, the most important piece of advice I'd give somebody is don't give up. Because as long as you keep trying, your odds improve because most other people will give up.
Mm-hmm.
Very good.
That's really great advice.
Then what is the likelihood that there will be a Sharknado 4? Like, what goes into...
Depends how many people watch Wednesday night at 9 o'clock on Sci-Fi.
Like, who factors that? Like, Sharknado 2 was a hit. Like, mm-hmm. It took a while to say, okay, we're going to do a Sharknado 3. So
no,
it's just
actually,
pretty much...
it didn't. Sharknado 3 was announced before Sharknado 2 even aired. I guess they have these tracking things, which I don't really understand, that predicts what the ratings will be like. And I guess they felt good enough about it that they greenlit Sharknado 3 before the second one premiered.
Are you already thinking Sharknado 4 just in preparation?
You know, it's funny because Anthony and I have talked about this, that we don't want to think about it. We want to concentrate on the third one and talk about this project and not get too invested and too excited about what a fourth one might be. But then at a certain point, everybody's asking you about it, and you can't help but think about it. And so I've been tossing out a few ideas, and I know Anthony has a few that he's talked about. I assume they'll make a decision after they see what the ratings are like for this third one. And if the audience is still there, if the fans want another one, I can't imagine we won't do one.
Well, even regardless, like, especially, you know, we talked a lot about, you know, the social age of Sharknado. I mean, you know, one of the nice things about it being in that age for film, you know, you can have a fundraising campaign. So if for whatever reason it doesn't pan out, I mean, I imagine there's enough fans, loyal fans, that will put in money to have a fourth, a fifth, and so on. And is that a route that you guys would be willing to take and, you know, to have it be self-funded that way?
I don't know. You'd have to talk to the guys at the Asylum about that. I mean, because they own it. You know, I would. I mean, if I were going to do a crowdsourced fundraising thing for a film, it would be something that I own and a project of my own that I want to do. And I've thought about that. You know, because it seems to me there are people who like Sharknado who might well support a film that I want to make, and that's sort of a fallback plan if nothing else works. But as to crowdfunding Sharknado, I honestly don't think it would ever come to that.
Right.
I mean, I know they did that to add a scene to the second one. The Asylum actually did a little Indiegogo campaign to shoot an extra scene. But, you know, as long as people are... If there are enough people to fund the film, I'm thinking there are probably enough people watching it who would be happy to watch it for free that the ratings will be good enough that Sci-Fi will just keep doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. So... All right, I want to talk TV because you and I share a common bond, Star Trek. You said you were, I had read, and once I saw those two words, I said, okay, this should be easy. And you said Star Trek, and then later on, and it was similar with me as well, Star Trek I grew up watching on TV and really influenced it got me into science fiction. I mean, first and foremost. And then when Star Wars came along, you know, after seeing things like Jaws and realizing what cinema can do or what a movie can do, and then Close Encounters. But then when Star Wars comes out, that takes things to another level. Still deep-hearted, still deep in with Star Trek. You're a big Star Trek fan as well. You said that influenced you into coming out here and taking a crack at all this. So I have to ask, A, what is your favorite episode?
I don't know if there's just one. I think there are three.
Okay.
And they're not none of them are the one that everybody says, which is City on the Edge of Forever. I would say Devil in the Dark.
Great one.
The Horda. Uh-huh. I would say The Trouble with Tribbles is my favorite comedy one.
Sure.
Balance of Terror.
Okay, right.
Which is basically a submarine movie set in space. And actually there's one more, is the one with the Gorn. I don't even remember
Arena.
The title. Arena, right. Yeah. So those are my favorite.
So, because I'm surprised, but sticking with the shark motif, one of mine, actually my favorite is the Doomsday Machine. The Doomsday Machine is literally Jaws in space before Jaws even became Jaws.
Right.
And you have Captain Kirk as Chief Brody, you have Commodore Matt Decker as Quint, and you have Spock as Hooper, about a big, giant, planet-eating machine that's going around the galaxy eating planets, and the Enterprise has to thwart this, and even the music is somewhat Jaws-like.
Right, but all of them are Moby Dick.
Absolutely.
So I mean you can go way further back than that. And really, you can go back to the Bible and the story of Jonah.
Absolutely. So I had to get the Star Trek out of the way, but I at least tied it into a shark and such. Growing up, too, being that this is Sharknado, how much of an influence perhaps was Jaws, being that it's celebrating its 40th anniversary?
Right. I didn't actually get to see Jaws in the theater when it was released. My parents wouldn't let me see it.
Mine almost didn't, too.
I almost got in. I was doing a sleepover with a friend. And his father was going to take us, but then he had to go do something. So he took us to the theater and was going to drop us off to watch the movie, and then he was going to go do what he had to do. And the theater wouldn't let him just leave us there, because we were like, what, 10 or 11, mm-hmm. I guess.
PG.
It was PG, but they didn't want unaccompanied kids, I guess.
Running around the theater.
Running around the theater or whatever. So they wouldn't let him do that. Or maybe they wanted him to buy a ticket and go in with us, and then he could have walked out, but he didn't have time to do that. So I never got to see Jaws in the theater, and I ended up seeing it on TV much later. So actually, for me, that moment was Star Wars, because all through the 70s, movies were pretty dark.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't fun. So for me, I remembered Star Trek, and that's what got me into science fiction. But most of my love at that point was for books and for bringing Star Trek back, because at that point there was still this whole fan movement to bring Star Trek back. But it didn't really look like it was going to happen, or maybe it would happen, but Spock wouldn't be in it, and what fun would that be?
Right.
And so when Star Wars came out and I went to see that, I poo-pooed it at first. I did not go to see it for a month.
Really?
Because it looked silly. It was cowboys and Indians in space. That's not science fiction. And then I went to see it, and sort of everything changed, because that was the first time I can remember having fun in a movie theater.
Right.
And it just blew my mind.
And then when you're talking Sharknado, just bringing it back, it's just fun watching TV, in a sense. And you were inspired. Can you tell some of the inspiration of B science fiction movies that you might have recalled while thinking about what you're going to write for Sharknado and stories like that?
I don't know. To be honest, I've never watched a lot of B movies.
Is that why you're so good at writing them?
I guess so. Maybe that's it. To be honest, the only Asylum movies I've ever watched in their entirety are mine. I probably shouldn't say that in public. I don't know. I mean, some of the old time, 50s ones like Creature from the Black Lagoon and stuff. I got into that, but I tend to, I mean, it seems to me most B movies are trying to be A movies and just failing.
Mm-hmm.
A Boy and His Dog is maybe a B movie. It was certainly a cult movie.
Absolutely.
That I watched and really liked.
Harlan Ellison.
Yeah.
Right.
Buckaroo Banzai, maybe. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you could really call it a B-movie, because they had money, but it was sort of a B-movie, and mm-hmm. I loved that. Yeah. If ever there was a movie that needs a sequel a reboot, it's that one.
I couldn't agree with you more.
How do you feel? There's I don't know if you're aware of it, but kind of in tandem with Sharknado, one of my new loves is it's called Zombievers, and they're coming out with a sequel called Zombies. I mean, right? I mean, the title.
I've heard of it. I haven't seen it.
I would recommend it. It's pretty good.
I just read a review, literally like 5 minutes before I got in the car to come here. A guy reviewed the third movie, and he said the beauty of Sharknado 3 is that the only justification necessary for anything to happen in this movie is that it's awesome. There's story justification, character justification, not necessary. As long as it's awesome, it can be in this movie. Yeah. Now, actually, I would disagree. I think we have justified everything that happened, but I like his approach. I like,
now, Thunder,
all we need to do is it's awesome.
Before you sit down and you get into your writing process, do you have any routines or rituals that you do to get into your writing mode?
For me, screenwriting is about 80% surfing the internet and 20% actually typing things into my computer. It's very hard to just sit there and write constantly for 8 hours a day. So I end up spending 12 hours a day at the computer, and a relatively small percentage of that time is actually typing. But I like to justify it by thinking that I'm allowing my mind to wander and find inspiration. I don't know if that's bullshit or not. But.
Now, you've made a career writing, obviously, but you've directed...
You know, here's the thing about that, is that, no, I'm a director who just happened to have chosen not to direct one particular movie, and that's the one that became a big hit. But I was always a director who wrote to have something to direct, and now all of a sudden, because of this one movie... The industry thinks of me, and I guess now the world, hello world, the world thinks of me as a writer, and that's actually been kind of weird and a little frustrating for me to deal with, because writing was never my main goal. I wanted to direct movies.
And you answered my question for me, because I was going to ask what you prefer to do more, but would you prefer to direct your own screenplays, or somebody says, hey, we have something that might be
good for you. Well, I am not above believing that there are other people who are better writers than me. So I would be happy to direct someone else's script if it were really good. I mean, there's a certain godlike omnipotence that comes from being the writer and director of a film, because it's all coming out of your head, and nobody can really question you, because you invented it, so all these decisions must be the right choices. But no, if I find a good script, I mean, actually a friend of mine wrote a good script that I tried to get going, and people, I don't know, it didn't quite hit other people the way it hit me.
Right.
But I would have directed that one in a heartbeat, so sure.
What's your, when you are given the opportunity to direct, what's kind of, your staple of directing? Like, if someone looked at that movie, oh, that's a Thunder Lovin' movie, like what would define it?
That's an interesting question. It would be science fiction or action adventure. It would be structured. I'm as a director, I'm a lot more like... This is going to sound egotistical, and I don't mean it that way, but I'm a lot more like Spielberg and Cameron in my approach than, say... Michael Bay or Robert Rodriguez, who will just have a lot of craziness happening and the camera's whipping back and forth. And I'm more of a structured, we build a scene piece by piece by piece. Everything's very precise. Probably the biggest difference between me and Anthony Ferrante as a director is that he likes to let things happen and capture them. And he'll let the actors improv and futz around with their dialogue and stuff. And I'm more precise. I wrote it this way for a reason. I'm structuring my shots this way for a dramatic purpose to build to this conclusion, sort of. So when I did American Warships, the scenes on the bridge actually feel very I don't know, they're like warm and fuzzy to me because they remind me of the scenes on the bridge of the Enterprise.
Right.
You know, there's the captain and there's an order to things. And that's not to say that I don't do chaotic action when that's what's required. In AE, I think I do that quite a bit. But it's chaotic with a purpose. So it would be structured to a dramatic purpose.
Okay.
Yeah, we talk about, you know, Phil and I host a show, Anatomy of a Movie, where that's what we do. We talk about specific movies for a week that had come out. So one of the things that we always bring up, too, is action. And today, how there seems to be, and it's been going on for a while, quick cuts. Like, and they say that's action.
And you can't even tell what's going on half
exactly,
the time.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't like that.
And letting a scene maybe play out so you at least can see the action on the big screen, which is something that sometimes gets lost. Which is bringing me up to a question because about a week ago we did Terminator Genesis and we talked about Alan Taylor as a director, as an action director, and how he's really good at choreographing so that you understand where characters are coming from and fighting. James Cameron is great at geography and telling you things like that. But another thing we talk about is marketing. And as a writer, do you, and I'm asking this because the writers of Terminator Genesis were sort of kind of kiboshed by the marketing. They gave away in the trailers the biggest twist there is. What is your thoughts on marketing as a writer? Have you been in a position where you've written something and then they, you know, marketing has sort of kind of messed something up? And what are your thoughts on marketing and film marketing?
Yeah, I mean, I sort of, I'm not going to bite the hand that feeds me.
Of course.
But I sort of feel like they've given away too much of Sharknado 3. There are bits in the movie that I've seen now in trailers and commercials that I really wish we could have kept as a surprise. You know, there were things that I would have liked to have had as a surprise that could never have gone through the whole process that way. I would have liked to have kept it a surprise that April was pregnant and then had a reveal. But by the time we even got to shoot that, it seemed like it was common knowledge that she was going to be pregnant. And, you know, the first time the paparazzi snap a picture of Tara Reid in her pregnant costume, that was a foregone conclusion. I had this great idea for the opening where we wouldn't know that Finn was getting this award. And I wanted that moment to be a reveal. Fortunately, we've been able to keep the ending secret so far, and I know there are reviewer copies out there floating around, and you know we're just hoping that nobody spoils it for people, because at least we want the climax to be a surprise when people get there. Just as a movie fan, I don't want too much given away, and you start. It's not the case on Sharknado 3, but you do start to worry when you see so much given away in a commercial and a trailer that maybe that's it.
Mm-hmm.
I actually enjoyed Terminator Genesis quite
a
bit.
So didn't we. And we actually felt bad for, like, Patrick Lussier and later for, you know, they too, they walked on tiptoes in answering these questions because it was just very blatant. But I find that, you know, marketing sometimes goes hand in hand, and it works in tandem so wonderfully. And I think Sci-Fi Channel, especially with the first Sharknado, you know, that's part of, like, you had a great title to work with. They had such a great concept that they really, I mean, it was their marketing that, it's, to me, in a sense, helped get people to watch. And then people were watching it and loving it so much that they just had to, you know, be able to tweet and talk about it. And TV lends itself to that more than movies. I don't want to go to a movie and have people with their phones out tweeting.
Right.
You can do it afterwards. That's great. But TV lends that. It makes a bigger water cooler. Mm-hmm. And I think the marketing really, that was a thing where it worked in tandem.
I thought the marketing for the first Sharknado was absolutely genius.
Yeah.
I mean, they did just the right amount. They teased it just enough. They made you see how ridiculous it was going to be. And you just had to watch.
Yeah.
And I don't know if maybe it's like the cameos, too. It's like we have to do so many cameos in this film now that it could almost... We handled it well, I think. But it, could almost get to the point where the cameos might start to get in the way of the story. Mm. And if there were to be any more cameos than what we had, it would be an issue. How do you fit all these different people who have to come and go? You know, because the whole point of a cameo is you can shoot it in a couple of hours. You know, that's a tricky thing, and we've had to deal with that, and I think we made it work pretty well. But it's something that we could go too far, and it could start to backfire on us. And I think the same thing can happen with showing too much of a film.
Sure.
I think, you know, the good news for this, I think it's a little bit different. You know, it's one of the, you know, when you revisit a film that you love, you know, you have the dramatic irony, now you're just enjoying it. I don't know, you know, for me, Sharknado, you can revisit 100 times, it's still as good as the first time. So, luckily,
I'm glad to hear that.
I think Terminator Genisys is a little bit different than, you know, this, so I wouldn't be too worried about it. We do have to start wrapping up soon, but so I want to take kind of final questions from Dimitri and Candace. Why don't we start with you, Candace?
What would you like to see happen with the Sharknado 4 if it, you know, comes about?
Well, I'd like to see it. I mean, I've been actually, the last few days, I've been pitching a bunch of really oddball right turn ideas.
Is it just to see what sticks, like to actual people, or just the press, just to see what sticks?
No, to the guys at the Asylum and Anthony and Sci-Fi. Just because I think we have to be careful not to get too formulaic. We have to keep surprising people. We have to keep being ridiculous in unexpected ways. So I've been sort of pursuing a lot of, you know, harebrained ideas and seeing which one might stick. But at the very least, I'd love to see it go global. I'd love to see a shark, you know, on the Eiffel Tower, or even better, Finn battling sharks in the Colosseum in Rome. This would just make me thrilled. But things like that, I think we need to open it up and travel a bit.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Excellent. Dimitri?
You could. Howard Stern fan at all, coming from New York?
Yes, although I haven't heard him in quite a while since he went to Sirius, because I don't have it. But I used to love Howard.
And, well, one of his we'll just call him crewmates, castmates, Benji Bronk.
Benji, yeah.
Now, he was in Sharknado 2. Mm-hmm. He had a cameo that you wrote for him. Now, it is rumored that he is potentially in Sharknado 3, and that there's a riff on his little incident that he had with Perez Hilton. So you don't know about what had happened.
He had an incident with Perez?
Perez, he lost a bet, and basically Perez had to use a finger, put it somewhere where the sun don't shine. And so the rumor is for Sharknado 3 that perhaps he has a shark tooth up there that Finn has to get out. Is this true or not true?
Is
he in the movie?
That's a rumor even more bizarre than Sharknado.
Well, I was just trying. Is he in the movie? I just started that rumor right here today, just grabbing for straws, just seeing if there was anything that you can give that's a spoiler that we don't already know. And is Benji Bronk in the movie? Can you say that?
I would watch the movie closely and intently and see if that is the case.
Because Phil, I didn't know that our own Maria Menounos was in the movie.
She's in my cameo scene.
Yeah, and I had no idea. So that's ruined for me. So anything else that can be put in. Because I do try to stay away from marketing, you know, on TV. But like I said, I loved what their first teaser trailer was. So anything that you could, as a Howard Stern fan,
as a movie fan, I maintain a spoiler free zone, and I will continue to do so as a filmmaker as well.
Fair enough.
All right, guys. Well, first off, thank you, Thunder, for joining us.
My pleasure. It was a lot of fun.
Where can our fans follow you?
On Twitter, at Thunderlevin. On Facebook, at facebook.com/ThunderlevinOfficial.
There you go. Okay. All right. And Dimitri, where can the good people follow you?
At DMovies1701.
And Candace?
You can find me on Insta, Twitter, and Snapchat. I just joined. I'm very good. Candy Buen with the IE.
And, of course, Sharknado 3, hell no, comes out July 22nd. on the Sci-Fi Channel. Definitely be checking that out, because if you're not, you will be so left out. And I'm not just saying that as hyperbole.
You will be. I felt left out after missing that first showing. I really did.
You won't know what the rest of the human race is talking about.
No, it was crazy. Thank you so much. This is such a true pleasure. Thank you.
All right, guys. We'll see you guys on the next iTalk Movies here on the Popcorn Talk Network.
Producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, Christian Harloff, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network. We would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only, and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.